podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We've got an interview with Ben Duckett to kick off today's show. We'll also try to work out what the SA20 means for world cricket, if anything at all. We've got some World Cup squad announcements, a bunch of ODIs to talk about as we get ever closer to the 50 over World Cup in India later this year. I'm Yaz Rana and with me today is Ben Gardner and Joe Harmon. Long-time listeners of the show will remember that about a year ago, we got Ben Duckett on to talk about his winter and his aspirations for 2022. At the time, he played just once for England in the previous 6 years and was very much on the outside of that England setup. A lot has changed for Duckett in the past 12 months, so here he is on his breakout 2022. Great to have you on, Ben. I think it's pretty much a year since we last spoke, and obviously a lot's changed since then. We're 11 days into the new year. How do you look back on 2022, where quite a lot of cool things happened to you?
I don't know, really. It's something that's probably I've been working towards for 3 or 4 years now, and I think to get the rewards for all the hard work I've put in, you know, with Notts, and I guess the scores I've got is really nice. It probably is the best year I've had so far, so yeah, fingers crossed I can keep that going.
What was it like getting that call up at the end of the South Africa Test series? The Test team were the talk of the town all summer. What was it like coming into that environment with Stokes and McCullum?
Yeah, it was obviously amazing to get that call. I wasn't around too much for that Oval Test. I was there for the first day and then I actually left just because I was going to Pakistan the next week. So I was just having some time, kind of time to chill and be away from cricket. Kind of the way that I play my cricket is, you know, based around how they do. And certainly this summer I went even more like how I used to play, and that was purely because I was watching, you know, the Test boys, and not necessarily I didn't change the way I was playing because I wanted to get a call up. I think there was a period of a few years, you know, Red Bull cricket, how you should play the game, and you know, at the top of the order you need to leave the ball well and bat for long periods of time doing that. And actually realized in my head watching those guys that, you know, you don't have to play like that. That's certainly, you know, whenever I've scored runs, it's not by doing that. It's by being aggressive and scoring runs. So, yeah, I mean, to be involved in this team right now is an extremely special time. And I think it's probably, if I was ever to play in an era of Test cricket, it would be this one.
And what was it like when you went to Pakistan with a Test squad? Obviously, you went on a tour of Asia when you were 21. How different was it coming into that dressing room at your age, 28, compared to when you're 21?
Yeah, I can't really compare because, you know, one side is a 20-year-old kid and the other one's a 28-year-old who's played a lot of cricket. So, to be honest, the environment in the dressing room when I played back then was fairly similar. Certainly with the players, I think there was maybe more pressure on you to perform, you know, back then. Well, there definitely was. And I think it was more based on, you know, if you don't score runs, media all over you, you're going to be out of the team. And it's kind of, it picks itself. Whereas this time, it was very different in the sense of, you know, this is our team led by McCullum, Stokes. And we've picked you because we believe you're good enough and we believe you can score runs at this level. And if you don't worry about it. Like, you're going to get your chances. And I think that's the biggest thing for me. And I think, you know, as a top order batsman, you need that backing and you almost need to go into it, you know, playing for England, not fearing that you're going to get dropped a game later. And I've actually used this word a few times, but I feel like at the top of the order in English cricket over the last 10 years, it's been a conveyor belt. And it's just been, you have a couple of games, on to the next person, on to the next person. And I don't think, looking back at the names who have played for England, I don't think they weren't good enough. I think you need time to settle into that environment and And yeah, I think that was the biggest thing for me. I mean, to start the series like I did, you know, kind of not that I had any pressure from, you know, anyone in the dressing room, but the pressure you have in your own self of, can I do it at this level? Yeah, I think to get 100 in the first innings just took all of that away from me and kind of takes pressure off even this next series coming up, because I know I've had such a great series there. And, you know, I'm not fighting it. I'm not chasing it, looking for a big score or looking for that first 100 in New Zealand or moving forward, because, you know, I've already got there, which is quite nice.
What was that moment like when you got to your first test ton?
It was a really weird moment, because I'm sure you'll know, like, we were all in bed for 2 days leading up to it. And yeah, that's probably the worst I'll feel on a cricket pitch, certainly playing for England. And yeah, I mean, I just tried to focus and give it absolutely everything. You know, really looking back, I probably thrown away the easiest double 100 going, you know, on a flat pitch and against the attack in those conditions. But all I remember is getting to 100 and, you know, all my energy and emotions had just, you know, gone through the roof. And as soon as I got to that moment, I just kind of decided I'm just going to try and hit every ball for four after this, because I just had nothing left in me, purely because I was just feeling ill and the 2 days before. So not quite how I imagined my first test 100, but yeah, I was just buzzing to get there.
So how close were you to not playing then?
Oh, so close. The day before, we were pretty much trying to push the test match back a day. Luckily for me, there was 10 of us ill, maybe more. And then the doctor came round and knocked on all of our doors at 7 a.m. the morning of the test match, basically saying, "Are you all right to play?" And to be honest, when I woke up, I wasn't feeling great. And I mean, Anita, our doctor, basically said quite a few of the lads have said they're up for it. Stokesy put a message on the group saying, "Let's go and get them." So just from then, it was like, all right, we'll get out there and get on with it.
So yeah, I knew that a lot of the players were ill. I didn't know that you were one of them. So what was said just before you went out there? Because you didn't just go out and score your first test 100. That was a record-breaking, all-time record-breaking day of test cricket. What was said? Was it just go out there and play your natural game, or was it let's go at sixes? What kind of chat was there before you went out?
If I'm totally honest, there was zero chat. Not one word was said. We obviously won the toss, and I think more importantly, everyone was buzzing, because I think all of our bowlers were ill. So I think they wanted an extra day off. So yeah, we just went out there and saw the ball, and you know, it was a belting pitch to bat on. So yeah, honestly, nothing throughout the whole day. And throughout the whole series, we didn't really, you know, if we were batting or, you know, not a lot was said. If we were bowling, there might be a few discussions about how we go about it. But in general, you know, even going into that last innings of the chase, not one word was said before we went out either. You know, I think that's a great place to be, that you can go out and play with that freedom and you're not even told to.
Where do you think that freedom comes from? Because no one has ever played like England did across those three test matches.
Well, I mean, they played like that throughout the whole of last summer, didn't they? You know, against good seam attacks in, at times, tricky conditions. It's pretty obvious where it's come from. I mean, Baz has come in as coach, and Stokesy leads by example in that sense, you know, as captain. So as I've only had a small taste of it, but for me, the biggest change has been since those two kind of took over.
Do you think we sometimes just overthink cricket? Like, actually, sometimes it's quite a lot more simple than we try to make it out to be.
Yeah, I think so. And I think maybe test cricket was portrayed in a way where you were told how you had to play it. And I think that's why it's so interesting now, you know, the way we're going about it and stuff. And I can think of numerous times in my career where I've faced a 74-mile-an-hour bowler on a green seamer, and I've just scratched around and got 20 off 50. And if that was next summer, I'm probably, you know, slog sweeping him into the short side or whatever it may be. And it's just, I think if you go out with the mindset of that, I mean, there's no ceiling. I think England have showed how far you can take the game in white ball cricket. And I think, you know, just because the balls are different colour doesn't mean you can't do that in red ball. I think there's certain times where you're going to have to respect the game and respect the conditions and respect good bowling. But it's actually amazing what you can do when you put your mind to go out and being positive.
What's the prep like between games? Because I saw England put out a few videos on the Instagram account of you guys just having a six-hitting competition on the eve of the game. Is it just like a very fun environment to be around in between test matches? Obviously, in Pakistan, it's a very specific environment where you're spending a lot of time in hotels, and it was a very, you know, compact series. It was basically three tests in 3 weeks. So yeah, what was it like being in and around the camp?
Yeah, it'd be like day off, golf, and then train. Yeah, the six hitting thing was a load of fun, I think, led by Stokesy and Baz. You know, it's probably important to say we did train after that, but it was a nice way to start training. But yeah, I mean, that would never ever have happened in the history of Test cricket before, but you know, before a last Test match. And to be honest, I think if it was one all going into that, we'd have done the same thing. Yeah, I think it was just to free everyone up, just have a bit of a laugh. But yeah, I mean, I think it's important when you're playing five of the Test matches to get away from it. And you know, most of the squad plays golf, and that's one way of switching off. And you know, fight you 15 days of cricket. You know, in the space of a short amount of time, you know, those valuable days off in between tests are just as important as going to have a 30-minute net session.
The pitch, particularly at Royal Pindi, was very flat, and one of the hallmarks of Stokes' captaincy so far is that England take 20 wickets every single time you go out on the field, and those are some of the hardest conditions to take 20 wickets. So what was it like being out there on the field with Stokes as captain, mixing up the bowling attack in the way that he did? He did some things that you'd not really seen that much before. When T's got out to Asia, he was very clever with his use of the seamers. So yeah, what was it like seeing Stokes at work on the field?
Yeah, there's not many dull moments, that's for sure. And that's during a 5-day test match on one of the flattest pitches, you know, ever to be played on. And the only reason why we got 20 wickets on that specific pitch was because of the field Stokesy set, you know, keeping everyone in the game throughout the whole time. You could very easily have one slip, a deep point, deep square, you know, a ring field, and it'd just be dull to watch. You know, I think at times Pakistan set fields like that to us. And on a flat pitch, it's so easy to just keep scoring at a low risk. When you've got these funky fields and people all around you, it's, as a batsman, it's a nightmare because, you know, they're in your vision. You don't really know if you want to hit the ball in front of you. And yeah, I actually, looking back, I think that was the most incredible thing, to take 20 wickets on that pitch. You know, really with no one who could bowl above 85 mile an hour, which shows the skill of the bowling and those guys, even in those conditions, and without, you know, mystery spin. You know, I think it was a ridiculous effort. But yeah, it makes things so much better in the field when those things are going on and you're in different fielding positions all the time and you got catches around the bat. It's far more fun.
And just on the timing of your return, do you think that you came back to international cricket at the right time? I know you played a bit in 2019, but do you think you benefited from coming back a bit later when you've just got that extra cricket under your belt and you're more sure about your game?
Yeah, definitely. You know, even 2 years ago, I wasn't, you know, wasn't really set in my game. I think it's only been the last 18 months really where I've just found something that's clicked, and especially in red ball. I think white ball, I've been pretty consistent for quite a few years now. But yeah, it was the first time I'd put an England shirt on in the T20 series and the Test series, feeling like I was properly ready to go and score runs at this level. And yeah, I say earlier, that's due to the, you know, the work I've put in with my coaches here at Notts over the last few years. So yeah, I mean, especially Red Bull, I feel like last year was the most consistent I was throughout the whole summer. And it was nice to go and play in Pakistan and go and play to my strengths as opposed to, you know, trying something different.
I've got to ask about your sweeping in that T20I series in particular. How did that develop? That's not something that is typically associated with English players. And I'm not sure anyone has ever had so many sweeps in their locker and used them so much as you did across actually the T20 and the Test series, to be honest.
Yeah. Again, it's like about knowing my game, and boundaries were generally quite short there. So, you know, I knew I was going to use the sweep, even the day before the first T20, I'd have had no idea I was going to play that many. I sometimes surprise myself with different options and areas I can hit the ball. But certainly in the last couple of years, you know, the 100 in the blast, it's been a strength of mine. And I think I've found, you know, so many different options now with the reverse and the sweep. One shot I didn't really play before was the paddle too much, but bringing that one in, you know, means spinners have to bowl slower to me, which actually makes the normal sweep shot a lot easier. But yeah, I've kind of realised that, you know, my game isn't hitting the bowler generally back into the side screen or over his head and taking on cow corner. If I've tried to find a game that is quite low risk for me and I can still score at a decent rate. And yeah, I just, obviously the two spinners I faced in that series spun it into me, which I find a lot easier. And yeah, with the small boundaries, it felt like I kind of could play a sweep or a reverse every ball and, you know, at low risk. And it was either, you know, one, two or four.
You did really well in both the T20s, then the tests, and you got an ODI series coming up. I remember you last year when we spoke, you talked about how you try and keep things relatively similar across formats. Is that still the case? Is that basically the way you see batters having to survive when you've got to switch between formats so often these days?
Yeah, I guess I can only speak for myself, but really, actually, I kind of play 50-over cricket how I play test match cricket or four-day cricket. It's, you know, see ball, hit ball kind of mentality. I would have normally said, you know, with playing the odd more risk with a scoop and stuff, but who knows? I might play one of those in the test series coming up now with this mindset of that England have got. But yeah, so for me, that, you know, the core of my game and everything is very similar throughout all three to pace and seam, really. So I don't really mind too much, you know, going from series to series. I actually find, you know, if I go and score runs in South Africa, I'll already be ahead going into New Zealand because, you know, runs under your belt and just feeling good.
Mm. There's a lot of chat, I guess, towards the end of the England summer about the high performance review. I remember last year you were talking about, because of the pitches at Trent Bridge have been reasonably bowler friendly in the past, you've actually, as a batting group, kind of batted quite positively to kind of get results on those pitches. So what do you make of all that chat around pitches and how much cricket there is, etc., at the moment?
Well, it's probably not for me to answer, is it? I mean, that's just for every county and what they want to do with their pitches. Yeah, you're right. When, you know, Trent Bridge is can be quite tricky at times, definitely first innings. And we kind of decided really as a group, we're going to be positive and try and score as quick as we can because we're going to get bowled out. I mean, you know, we'd rather get bowled out scoring 50, 60 more runs than we would. But yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what happens moving forward in county cricket. You know, things, you know, counties can be, you know, play the game however they want. And, you know, some people are going to keep doing what they want to do. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in, you know, in cricket and pitches and if sides are starting to play more like the England team or if they, you know, just stick to how they want to play.
And then finally, at the start of the new year, what are your hopes for 2023? Do you sit down and kind of pinpoint targets, or is it you just kind of take every series, every competition as it comes?
No, I never set targets. I mean, this year, I mean, I'd love to be sitting here this time next year and I'm still, you know, wearing an England shirt in all three formats. Certainly one or two of them at least. And at the end of the day, if I'm going to be doing that, then I'll have had a good year and scored quite a few runs. So yeah, I wouldn't set, you know, I wouldn't put a ceiling on anything, but it would be nice to, you know, I'd love to, you know, score runs in an Ashes, you know, win an Ashes series and contribute to that. I mean, that would just be incredible. If you'd have told me 12 months ago I was going to be, you know, there or thereabouts for an Ashes series in the summer, I certainly wouldn't have believed you. Yeah, so, I mean, it's an exciting summer with, you know, obviously you've got all my stuff at Notts. We're back in Div 1 this year. So, you know, depending on how much cricket I play for them, I'm not sure at this moment in time, but, you know, the games I am there, I want to, you know, get a couple of wins under our belts for the team. You know, whatever happens in the 100 as well, it's always an exciting comp to play in. And there's so much cricket for England, I think, this summer. You know, there's white ball stuff at the back end, and 50 over World Cup in October. I mean, yeah, the two big ones are probably those, and you know, to represent your country in a World Cup would be amazing.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for your time, Ben, and have a great couple of tours to South Africa, New Zealand.
Thank you, mate.
Joe, you spoke to Duckett before he went out to Pakistan, so you've heard a lot from him recently. So what did you make of that interview?
Yeah, it was a good interview. He always gives a bit more than it feels like you're getting. He's quite understated, not hugely expressive, but he's quite honest. And I've found that when I've spoken to him in the past as well. I spoke to him a few weeks before he went out to India in 2016. Sorry, Bangladesh and India in 2016 for his debut. He'd just scored about 2,000 runs in a season for Northants. He'd won the PCA Young Player and Player of the Year award. And he was clearly riding high. And I think he might admit himself he was probably a bit complacent about what Test cricket might demand of him at that point. And he got a 50 in Bangladesh, but then went to India and got Ashwin, basically. Just found it very difficult, as a lot of left-handers do against Ravi Ashwin. There's no shame in that, but I think he was probably relying on his talent at that point and didn't have the kind of nous around his game that he's developed since. Then I spoke to him just before he went out to Pakistan, and he was, again, very confident. And he talked about, if I'm facing spin, my sweep is basically my forward defence. And I was like, there's a fine line between confidence and arrogance, and it's basically decided by how well you go. And he's gone so well, and that now looks like a great line. But I did slightly fear for him going out there, despite the fact that I think he's a really good player. And yeah, I'm delighted it's gone so well for him. And I think there was a sense that he was maybe a kind of horses for courses selection because he's so good against spin. But he's definitely done enough to earn a spot that's shown that he can be an opener for all seasons. A couple of things that jumped out for me in that interview, he referred to this England team as our team. And Ollie Pope said exactly the same to me. There's a clear sense that the players have ownership of this team in a way that they didn't feel they had before. It's almost like a kind of county or even a club, the way they talk about it. But you know, when it's going great is fantastic. When it goes wrong, people will probably start to say it's a bit cliquey, but you know, hopefully we don't get to that stage too soon. But he's a cricketer who's had to bide his time, and as he said himself there, that's probably been no bad thing for him. He's really learnt his game. He knows what works and what doesn't, and hopefully he's set for a real good stint for England across all formats, or certainly the test format for a while.
I liked what he said about before that first day and that first morning in Rawalpindi, when they obviously went out and broke basically every record there's ever been on day one of a test match. And at the end of the game, we were sort of praising Ben Stokes and Brendan McCullum's sort of strategic genius for this plan they'd put into place. They knew they had to score so quickly to get all those runs and then take 20 wickets. And then he goes, so what was said to you? What was the plan? He's like, didn't say anything at all. Which, you know, from one point of view is like, what even is this new thing? But I think it actually shows how deep-rooted this new way of playing is. That actually, and it's, you can think of probably Ben Stokes being like this brave heart type leader, delivering, you know, these impassioned speeches and telling people to, you know, to go out and be themselves and to do it for king and country and whatever. When actually it's the time when they choose to speak, it seems, is what's making the big difference. And almost maybe everything they've needed to be said was said basically before on tea on that fifth day at Trent Bridge, basically. That was the thing. And as soon as that happened and that worked, you almost don't need to say it again because you've already said everything you need to say, essentially. But yeah, and it's interesting that there was a piece this week, I think, by Tim Wigmore in the Telegraph about how they had a chat with the counties, basically saying like, we would like you to play like we do. Not a demand, although when Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes say we would like you to do something,
you do it,
I'm sure
you?
That's quite hard to turn down. But it's interesting that even that needs to be said, because Duckett was saying in that chat that he wasn't even doing it to get picked for England. He just saw it and was like, that kind of looks like fun. That looks like it would suit me, so I'm going to do that as well. And it worked for him. And you'd think counties might do that naturally, or at least some players would do that naturally, I guess.
Sam Northeast said the same when we spoke to him last summer before he went and scored a 400 as well, that it wasn't necessarily driven by getting back into the England team. It's just like, well, why don't I play like that? It looks so, you know, simple and fun. It's the way everyone wants to play cricket and then sort of forgets about as they get further along in their career. But yeah, it is, you know, when we sit here, it's slightly disconcerting when we sit here and analyse these matches and talk about the genius involved, and then Ben Duckett says, zero chat, not a word was said. We're like, oh. There is definitely something in keeping it simple, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. The thing that I was probably most struck by was was hearing just how ill he was before he scored his first test 100. And I liked what he said about, like, he basically thought there was a double 100 there for the taking, which again demonstrates his confidence. He's not scored a test 100 yet, but he's disappointed he didn't score a double.
I wondered, you know, when he said he was about 10th in line, by that point everyone had said yes. I wondered if Ben Foulkes was the first in line, because he was the only one who was like, oh, well, I don't think any of us are going to play. So, yeah, I'm not feeling too good. Yeah. Then everyone after says, yeah, I'm up for it. Why not?
And also, Ben, you said there weren't as many Ben Stokes Braveheart speeches as you might have hoped for, but there was that WhatsApp message that he sent out, that let's go get him, when everyone was in bed.
That's a very modern Braveheart message, isn't it? A WhatsApp message.
Maybe it was a voice note, yeah.
We have a new T20 league, and there's another one that gets underway soon as well. The SA20 started on Tuesday in South Africa with their equivalent of the El Clasico, Par Royals versus MI Cape Town. Plenty of high profile English representation, including Jofra Archer making his first competitive appearance since July 2021. He took 3 for 27 from his 4 overs and looked very good. Ben, before we get onto the SA20 as a whole, it was just great to have him back.
Oh yeah, it was so good. And obviously, you know, it's been so long. And actually, even obviously people talk about how long it's been since his last game. It's been longer than that, really. He's had this struggle with injuries going back to early 2020, really, when he first had that elbow stress fracture. And, you know, obviously we hope that this is the one that sticks, basically. But I think the main thing that I took from this was that, you know, even if this is, you know, for one tournament, or, you know, for a few months or for years, until, you know, that we get Jofra Archer sort of without any of those kind of worries, it's just good to, like, enjoy him when you have him, because this was it was brilliant. And there was all the teasing in between. I don't know if you saw the slow-mo vid that MI Cape Town put up of him, like, running in with the cap on backwards and the chain bouncing. And I think he's put on some muscle, I think, since that time. And he's quite sort of slight and willowy, and now it looks like he's got this, like, the shoulders are broad, the biceps are really sort of, like, bulging out, which was notable from that thing. And then, so then MI win the toss and choose to bowl. And so you're excited about Jofra Archer taking the new ball. And then Rashid Khan throws the ball to George Linder, who, obviously, very good bowler, getting through an over of spin first over T20 is a common tactic, so that's fine. But I think quite a lot of people wanted to see Jofra Archer steaming in, and then Sam Curran takes a second over, and it's like, when is this going to happen? And then the third over comes, and it is, yeah, it's everything that you kind of have remembered Archer being, especially that first ball was just the absolutely typical Jofra Archer T20 new ball, the one that's, like, sort of that hard short of a length. There's some seam movement, there's kind of more bounce that you're expecting from that kind of smooth action. And yeah, Wihan Luba, the opener, just didn't really have a hope, and then tried to play a big shot, hit it up in the air. Jason Roy comes in and is leaving it. And this is Roy, who is, you know, the most attacking of all of England's super attacking white ball players, is giving respect to Jofra Archer in that first over.
Got up to 90 mph as well.
Yeah, yeah, he was still there, bowling really quick. And yeah, he also bowled the 19th over, which I think went for two runs and took two wickets. And there was a really, really lovely slower ball in there as well, which I can't remember who it was, but the batter was miles early on it. And yeah, it was just great to see him back.
It's hugely exciting to see him again. You kind of almost forget how good he was or is. When I came into the office just afterwards, our colleague Toby, who does the commercial side of things here, was visibly excited about the SAT20 opener, which I wasn't expecting, I have to say. And that was all because of Jofra Archer. And he said, quite rightly, there's no one else like him. And there isn't. And his immediate question was, do you reckon he'll play in the Ashes? Because that's obviously where our minds are wandering at this stage. And, you know, Ben Stokes tweeting, buzzing, buzzing, buzzing to see him back. Sure, part of that will be because he knows what Jofra's been through and he'll be pleased to see his teammate playing again. But also, that's Ben Stokes, England Test captain, talking. He wants Jofra Archer as part of his Ashes squad, and, you know, he's not going to play 5 Tests this summer, no chance. But Mark Wood probably won't either. Imagine if you can kind of dovetail those two express quicks at their best, if we can get to that point and keep them both fit. Several ifs in there, but it would be hugely exciting.
And Ollie Soane as well, who's a teammate of Archer in the SA20. He was really quick. I thought he looked very good as well. We're only 2 games into the competition, and I think it was a very good choice to have that game first, because I think those are the two best teams. I think people's impressions of the tournament, I think the tournament looks really good, but I think will be slightly higher than it probably will be in a week time, because that was the opening game. And it was a missed opportunity to not have Archer bowling to Butler as the first ball of the competition, instead of having George Linder to Wihan Luba.
Yeah, I saw that. MI Cape Town did one of those kind of dressing room videos afterwards, and it was Archer being sort of congratulated on coming back, and he gave a little speech, and he was like, I hope by the end of this tournament we feel like a proper team, and we know when each other bowl and when each other bat. And I thought maybe that was a message to Rashid Khan. Like, you give me the new ball, right? You give me the new ball.
Alec asks, I know it's completely unrealistic and it will never happen, especially in the modern full throttle era. But having just watched Jofra Archer dive arse over tits for a ball at mid-off and take what seemed like an eternity, to an England fan at least, to get back to his feet, it was probably about 10 seconds after having 17 months out. Do you think there's a case for certain players to, well, just take it a bit steady in the field? I think there's every time that Root or Anderson dives full length into the advertising hoardings to save one run. I often think, just leave it, Jimmy. Let them take that one run and we'll keep you on the park and you'll take 30 more wickets this year. Surely some resources are just a bit too precious. As I say, I know it'll never happen and I might still emotionally be scarred from Simon Jones at Brisbane back in 2002, but I did wince when Archer went down and stayed down.
It's Ben Stokes for me. It's just like, leave it, Ben, honestly. Yeah, we know you really care and you try hard, but just leave it. But it's quite an interesting question, because the idea would be that you'd be labelled indispensable, so you can't dive, but other people would be like, yeah, you go for it. We're not too fussed about you, so you throw yourself into the hoardings and see how you get on.
We had quite a few questions on the SA20s. Obviously, Pete, a lot of people's interest. So Philip asked, how many T20 competitions is too many? And Patrick asked, this week feels rather poignant as the first real shift in fans now starting to follow the players rather than the teams in these T20 leagues. Everyone knows Archer bowled a maiden in his first over, but does anyone know or care who he bowled for or against? Ben, you've watched most of the first two games, if not all of them. What have you made of the competition so far? And is it a bad thing? Is it a good thing?
Well, it's definitely, I mean, as ever, these things always have good sides and bad sides. It's interesting what he says about the lack of identity, because I think there's a concerted effort actually by some of these Indian team owners to create an identity across these leagues. So with Jofra Archer, the team he was playing for was MI Cape Town, which is the Mumbai Indians owned team in the South Africa League. And the same with Par Royals, owned by Rajasthan Royals, and had Joss Butler opening the batting, you know. So there is an effort to create a bit of an identity across these teams. And you had, you know, Javel Brevis in that MI Cape Town team as well, who obviously was in a way unearthed by Mumbai Indians last year. But then that is itself odd. You do feel a bit like you're watching sort of like an Indian Premier League spin-off, because I mean, I guess that's almost what it is. But it is also just like really fun. I mean, I feel like it's weird actually, you almost don't see too much T20 cricket played in South Africa. I mean, they've struggled to create this kind of profile of league for a long time, and just they haven't hosted a T20 World Cup in a while. And you'd think it should be perfect for it to have, you know, its own spin on it. You know, you think you've got like really hard fast tracks. I mean, the first game wasn't like that, but if you what you think of it in your mind as is, you know, hard fast tracks, thin air, so the ball travels miles,
small boundaries,
fast bowlers, this endless production line of sort of big burly South Africans who can hit it and who can bowl it quickly. That sounds like, just from the raw materials, is a very like attractive T20 package. And I think that will play out. I mean, we've seen already new players start to announce themselves, like what Donovan Ferreira, who I know
he's amazing.
People have been excited about him, but this is the kind of platform that will, you know, will get him deals and fans around the world. So like, I think it's weird. I think although the identity is clearly, there is an identity that is attached to the Indian Premier League, I think it will be able to form its own identity as something that appeals to fans globally. Hopefully this is something that enables South African cricket to keep going as as a going concern, basically, and to fund, you know, the other stuff that we like about South African cricket, that, you know, to have those teams competing in Test cricket and being threats at world events, and it can be its own entertainment package. So at the moment, I think I'm broadly in favour of it, while also recognising that there are some oddities to it with that IPL influence, I guess.
From a very kind of English-centric perspective, I think it's got quite a bit going for it in the time it falls. You know, the IPL, there's always that, you know, I know a lot of people in this country love the IPL, but there is also a lot of people who don't like it because it eats into the county season, and you've got this kind of conflict where the English season starts, but the attention is elsewhere, a lot of the best players are elsewhere. Whereas this league is arriving at a time when there's not a huge amount else going on. Minds are starting to wander to cricket if you're thinking about the new season, so it's almost kind of like a gateway into it. You know, South Africa is a fantastic place to play cricket, so a lot of English players are going to be involved. So I think from a purely English perspective, I think there's going to be a reasonable amount of interest in it.
I was trying to think what I think about it. I was trying to compare it to a lot of bilateral cricket, where it's played in front of not particularly packed houses, and this only two games in, but they've got big crowds in. And also, I think for me, the looking at how much people are being paid, I think I remember when the 100 started, a lot of people made the point, it's great that someone like Tom Abel doesn't have to play for England to earn a lot of money. Tristan Stubbs is being paid about £500,000 for this 1 month tournament, which is also, by the way, about four times what the best paid player in the 100 gets. So I think competitions like this will have consequences for the 100. And we already saw, we talked about it before we started recording, that we already saw in 2022 that the men's 100 was already struggling to attract and keep the best players for the entire competition. I think that competition like this will make that even harder for the 100. But I think it is a good thing that South Africa are able to pay their really talented players a lot of money early on. I mean, South Africa for years has had talent drain, really, really good players seeking a living elsewhere, because unless you're playing for the South Africa team, it's really hard to maintain a living in South Africa. So I think that is definitely a good thing. I'm not that fussed if bilateral cricket declines and you get, and it's replaced with cricket with full houses like this, that's fine for me.
Bilateral white ball cricket.
White ball cricket, sorry, yeah. Bilateral white ball cricket.
That's so quite this is important.
I worry about test cricket, but I'm not sure if this, does this accelerate the decline in test cricket? I don't know. I don't really know.
It's certainly another thing to squeeze into the calendar. It's another thing for players to see where they can earn a lot of money. If you're a fast bowler, as we've talked about on the show previously, and you can earn that money playing in South Africa, and you don't earn that much playing test cricket for South Africa, what are you going to decide to do? And that's so the question you asked at the top, is this important? Well, even if you don't care about it, even if you don't watch a single ball of this tournament, if you care about test cricket, it is by extension an important development, just like the other ILT20. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Just from a kind of basic point of view, in terms of what South Africa's home season looks like. I mean, we talk about it here when you have the 100 and they have that window for it. And that, I mean, it squeezes international cricket to other points, but at least our season is quite long. So you can have the season earlier and later. In South Africa, this might well just cut into when they can host test cricket. So it might be that those, you know, what we've already seen, that those three test series would have played have become two test series. And I guess this is part of the reasons they want to fit in this other thing. It is interesting on the calibre of players, because not only are the calibre of overseas players probably a cut above the 100, but actually the calibre of English players is a cut above the 100 as well. I think you would have seen a game in the 100 with the calibre of English talent as in that first game in the SA20 with what, Butler, Roy, Archer, I mean, and Butch.
Morgan, Stone. Yeah,
exactly. But Butch predicted it actually, and we did see it earlier this year, or sorry, in last year, when English players, like the top name England players, especially the multi-format ones, do actually see that sort of that gap in the 100 where they're supposed to be playing as almost an opportunity for rest, basically. And so it's an odd situation where you have like guys like Butler just doesn't play much 100 and does play lots of franchise T20 stuff elsewhere, and yet he's supposed to be, like, you'd think the 100 he would be one of the draw cards, and yet he is a draw card for other competitions, which is odd, I guess.
Also, the pay thing, test cricket, international cricket has not been able to create a model where players like Donovan Ferreira get paid a lot of money. That's been a problem for ages, and international cricket has never really been able to solve it, so that's definitely a good thing. But yeah, I don't know what I think about what this means for test cricket in South Africa, but that was already on the decline before this tournament came in, so I don't know. Kind of linked to that, Joe, what is your moment of the week?
Yeah, it is linked to that. I was hoping it was going to come to that, because they do kind of tie in together sort of quite nicely. My moment was yesterday reading an interview by Mel Farrell, the Australian broadcaster and writer, which is going in the next issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly, which we sent to print yesterday. Most of our listeners probably know who Mel is, but if they don't, she's worked for Cricket Info for many years and she's now gone freelance. We got her in the magazine a few months ago. She's already interviewed Faf du Plessis and Matthew Mott for us, both great interviews, and she's gone up another notch this month by getting Ricky Ponting for us. It's a great interview. She spoke to him during the Sydney Test against South Africa at the end of an Aussie summer, which is, I think it's fair to say, has kind of failed to capture the imagination. Very one-sided test series, a one-day series against England that no one turned up to. They bummed out in their own T20 World Cup. There's kind of the sense that a lot of the Aussie public aren't necessarily behind Pat Cummins and his team, despite how well they're doing. It's hard to get a gauge on that from here, but Adam Collins has written similar stuff in columns for us in the magazine as well. But Ponting, the key point, there's loads in there, and yeah, I'd urge you to read it when it comes out. So I won't give away too much, but the stuff he talked about related to the South Africa series, I thought was the most kind of pertinent. As a direct quote, Ponting said he'd never had genuine fears for the future of Test cricket before, but watching Australia-South Africa, he did for the first time. And his quote was, "I've never been worried about Test cricket until I've seen this team here at South Africa. Absolutely. People have been pointing fingers at T20 cricket, but every country is playing T20 cricket. It's not just one or two that are playing. I mean, England play more than anyone else, and look at the Test cricket they're playing at the moment. So it can obviously have a really good positive effect on Test cricket as well. The West Indies, who toured before South Africa and Australia, you can trace that back 20 or 30 years. You can understand their demise, but it's harder for me to understand South Africa being this. If that is the best group of players that they've got, then I think it's an issue for the world game for sure." So strong stuff from Ponting there. He goes on to say he thinks the ICC needs to find a way to fund test series which don't feature the big three. And again, I quote, "because these guys right now, the West Indies and South Africa, probably need the money more than ever." Strong stuff. When you hear someone like Ricky Ponting suddenly saying he's got fears for the future of test cricket, it makes you sit up, it makes you worry. Most of us already have these fears, but it's kind of poignant that sitting there at Sydney watching that game unfold, in fairness that was a draw because it rained, but South Africa got kind of thumped in the first two, was a trigger for Ponting to think, well, how long is this thing going to last? And I think he doesn't specify. I think he's talking about outside the big three, in inverted commas. So yeah, genuinely concerning stuff. Interesting thoughts on Bazball too. He says it's probably not that different to what we did, kind of casually out the side of the mouth, but he's clearly excited by what England are doing. And he looks ahead to the Ashes a bit, full of praise for Duckett, for Brooke, even for Ben's man Crawley, and says too many of the England players who visited Australia for the Ashes just, again, I quote, made cricket look too hard. He name checks Hamid, Burns and Sibley, which I thought was a bit unfair because he wasn't even there, but I think I understand the point he's making. So we'll talk a bit more about what's in the magazine next week just as it comes out, but yeah, it's a great one from Ponting, who just, you know, it's so nice when he just loves the game so much. It's like an interview with a really, really knowledgeable fan who just has so much passion for it. And it's not all doom and gloom at all. There's lots of positive stuff in there as well.
There's an amazing video from the Big Bash this week where they put out a clip of Ponting in the first week of the competition, where he basically said that bowlers acclimatized to T20 competitions much, much quicker than batters do. And as a result, chasing, you'll see more teams be successful chasing as the competition pans out. And that is exactly what has happened in this Big Bash. And there are quite a few examples of him perfectly predicting wickets just before they've happened.
Prithvi Shaw.
That was the most famous one. Yeah. I think
the Prithvi Shaw one was funny because he'd been his coach at the, Delhi Capitals. So it's like, if you knew this was coming, could you not have said something back then rather than now? But yeah.
The Women's T20 World Cup is less than a month away. England announced their squad last week. Alice Capsey is there despite breaking her collarbone last month. England have said they wanted to give her every chance of recovering. Izzy Wong is not in the squad. She's a reserve, as is Danny Gibson, an all-rounder who has not before played for England. Kate Cross won a recall. She's not played a T20I since 2019. There's no Tammy Beaumont, and Lauren Winfield Hill is in. Ben, what are your thoughts on the squad as well as England's chances?
Yeah, I think the squad is broadly as I expected to be. I suppose the one thing is the lack of Izzy Wong, and also the split between what, four quicks, three spinners in the squad, says something about what they expect conditions to be like, which sounds not like how I described T20 cricket in South Africa a little bit before. Like you'd think if there were pitches with a bit of juice in them, then Izzy Wong could be a really exciting prospect, but they've chosen to go another way. Their prospects, I mean, I think they go into it as third favourites, and reasonably, not distant third favourites, but there is a gap between them and the top two. I'm really glad that Lauren Winfield Hill is in it, despite not absolutely lighting things up on her return. There was a fear that she would come back and then she'd, you know, have quite a short go in conditions that were pretty tricky for batters, and then would be sort of they'd be like, oh, okay, we've seen enough sort of thing. But I'm glad that she is in there because she did have such a good home summer. And I think there are real reasons to think that she might well have turned a corner and be kind of the player that she kind of looked like she could be at times, but kind of never was consistently. And I think that there are reasons to think she could be. So yeah, I mean, England will have a decent chance, and I think they should get the semi-finals.
But with a new coach in place and just with how good India Australia are, I think anything more than that is a bit of a bonus. But it's T20 cricket and anything can happen, I suppose, in those knockout games.
Yeah, I think Kate Cross is a really good pick. Pleased to see her back in. I think they missed that experience against India at the back end of last summer where it all got a bit wayward with the ball. It's a bit strange she hasn't played more. She's become the sort of, as she described herself, the Liam Plunkett role in the 50-over stuff, just in the middle overs. But I think she's got more to offer. I think Ben's point's interesting in terms of the balance of the squad. I wonder if it's actually more just to do with playing to their strengths than the conditions they expect. Charlie Dean was absolutely brilliant in the Caribbean, has made herself undroppable. Eccleston obviously plays, and Sarah Glenn's got a great record. I think she's number two or number three in the world in T20 bowling. So I think all three of them play almost regardless of the conditions, and then it's just however you fit the rest of them in. Izzy Wong was expensive against India, and I think there's still that sense that she hasn't got the control that you probably need in T20. And the pace, whilst it is good, it's not so electric that it makes her a kind of automatic pick on that basis. And in terms of the chances, I think they'll get to the final and lose to Australia.
Say bold. Australia named their squad this week. Meg Lanning returns to captain them after her break from the game, and Georgia Wareham is included, having done her ACL in 2021.
Yeah, on that, I think that people... not obviously, it is great to see Meg Lanning back. That's obviously great. You know, she's the maybe the preeminent batter women's cricket has ever had, and so to see as much of her as possible is good from a fan's point of view. If you're a fan of one of the other teams, you might have been looking at that Australia team a little while out. There were, I think, fitness concerns over Alyssa Healy, obviously, if Meg Lanning weren't to make it, and so you'd be looking, okay, that's maybe like maybe they aren't that super strong Aussie, but not just that. Georgia Wareham back, and she's had, it was an ACL in 2021, I think, that she did, and they have lots of very, very good leg spinners in Australia, but I think they see her as the leader of the pack. It'll be interesting to see how they go actually between her and Alana King, who has obviously emerged since then, but Wareham was definitely first choice back then. And then also with Elise Perry, who is now, like, there were questions over her in T20 cricket at times, and fairly so, and it looked like Talia McGrath might have come in and taken that all-rounder spot. And she has always been a player who has looked to sort of improve and add more things to her game, even when she was the most complete all-rounder that, you know, the game has ever seen, basically. Mm. And then she goes and smashes, what, 2 40-ball 70s against India. She's got 2 back-to-back 100s in her last 2 games in domestic cricket. And so she is, like, maybe right now as good as ever with the bat. And yeah, it's very hard to see anyone stopping them, and even more so given who they've been able to include in their squad.
Moving on, Australia have named an 18-man squad for their upcoming tour of India. They named 4 spinners, Nathan Lyon, Ashton, Agar, Mitch Swepson, and the 22-year-old uncapped off-spinner, Todd Murphy. Lance Morris, who is supposed to be properly fast, has been included as well, and there's a decent chance that he plays with fitness concerns over Mitchell Starc. The noises coming out of the Australia camp at the moment seem to suggest that Agar will probably start the series, maybe Swepson. Those two will be preferred to Murphy at the start, not because they're necessarily better than Murphy, but because they spin the ball in the opposite way to Lyon, and India are likely to have a top 6 with 5, maybe even 6 right-handers. We're going to cover this series pretty closely once it begins. I think it's got the potential to be amazing. Joe, how do you see it going after the announcement of the Australia squad?
Yeah, it's an interesting squad, especially the Ashton Agar, who seems likely to play from the bits I've read, that they want a left-arm spinner there. But there are sort of echoes of what England have to do here. They've plucked someone who's got no record in domestic cricket. I think he's averaging 50 with the ball over the last 3 years, just in the hope that he can go and do something in the subcontinent. And that never fills me with a great amount of confidence, given the players he'll be up against. I suppose Australia, I think, are in a better position to compete than they have been of late. But I still don't think they've got enough to win out there. I think Travis Head, who's been absolutely brilliant in home conditions, hasn't been as good away from home and isn't as good against spin. So I think I don't think we can expect him to continue his form in India. Warner's not got a great record out there. So when those pieces start to look not so solid, and the spinners, you know, Lyon obviously his record is indisputable, but the backup spin is not great. I think they're going to be struggling to win more than a match out there.
I do agree with quite a lot of that, especially the Ashton Agar thing. I find it quite puzzling. I mean, he wasn't threatening in that test at the SCG. I just if you're expecting him to out bowl India's spinners, that is a huge ask. And I think I would go with Swepson, partly because I think you have to respect what he did in Australian domestic cricket for a number of years, is kind of basically, he was even like had numbers that were comparable or better than Nathan Lyon at times in the Shield. And also, like, I was looking back at his first stint in the Test side when they taught Pakistan and Australia, and okay, he had some pretty ugly figures in Pakistan when a lot of players did, but there were signs of improvement. I mean, he took 5 wickets in the win in Sri Lanka, and bowled some really good balls. And I think, you know, he's a leg spinner in Test cricket. It's going to take a bit of time. And if you're going to just pick a guy for, you know, a couple of series that he doesn't even play the whole of the first one, and then think that you've seen enough and then go to someone else, then you're going to, Australia going to keep having this problem, and they don't really win in turning conditions. That's been a problem for them for a long time. I think the Lyon thing is interesting, because actually his record in Asia is not great considering his stature within Australian cricket. I mean, he's got an average of 32 there. He's had some very, very good performance there, where he took an 8 for in one test. But
bowled very well in Sri Lanka, didn't he?
Yeah.
Last year.
But he's yet to properly dominate a series in Asia, which is quite a significant box to be unticked for a spinner who is kind of, whose numbers otherwise are up there with one of the greats of the games. And then on the batting, like I totally agree that, I mean, I don't think you can expect all of Warner, Quadra as well. You'd bracket in there as having a not great record in those sorts of conditions, and Head to have a great series. But actually, I think Australia might only need one of them to have a decent series to be really competing with India, because India's batting lineup is also similarly shaky in a way. I mean, especially with Rishabh Pant, if he does miss the series, that's a huge blow for them.
He's definitely missed the series.
So that's, I mean, then you're looking at that, and actually, although the names are big, you're thinking of how they've gone recently and where are the big runs going to come from. And so for that reason, it'd be interesting to see what conditions they go with as well. Like, do they just go with the kind of pitch we saw for the last 3 tests of the England series and just back themselves to out bowl Australia, which they would, but then you've got to also out bat them. And actually, looking at that, the 2 batters I'd expect most score runs across both sides would be Labuschagne and Steve Smith.
Yeah, it's interesting with the Indian batting at the moment. So we've just, in the upcoming issue of the magazine, we've got our men's test 11 of 2022, and we had a 31 strong panel people vote for their 11, including you guys. And no one on the 31 strong panel picked a single Indian specialist batter across the whole year. So Pant received plenty of votes as a keeper bat, but no Indian batter, which, given their resources and given the talent, is quite an extraordinary stat. And also, the year previously, our team was kind of being dominated by Indian players, and certainly the vote was, I think, 2/3 of the votes went to Indian players. So it's a funny place that Indian batting finds itself, because there is so much talent, but it's not necessarily working. The pitchers obviously have something to do with that at home. I mean, I'm sure they won't do it, but I just like, we'll just prepare a proper pitch and you know, back yourselves to win, because I think they would do anyway. This isn't a groundbreaking comment, but I expect Cody to have a big series. I think it's time that turned round in Test cricket. There's enough signs in white ball cricket that he's back. Yeah, and just quickly on Ben's point on Swepson, I mean, it'd be crazy not to play him. I think, you know, if you don't pick an up and coming leg spinner on this tour when you're basically already in the World Test Championship final, pretty much, it's almost a free hit. No one really expects them to win. And when are you going to do it? And it's not as though Agar is such a great containing spinner that you can expect him to do that job. I mean, Agar will probably go for quite a few runs and not take wickets, and Swepson will probably go for a few and might take some scalps.
Yeah, no, I do see that. I'd be tempted to play Murphy just for quite similar reasons as to why you'd go for Swepson if it is a bit of a free hit. I think Murphy might be properly good, and if that's the case, and he's, I mean, this is quite a good time.
Played 7 first class matches, I saw. It's a bit of a, yeah, not quite Rian Ahmed, but not that not, far off.
And he's not got a 5 yet either.
He's not his state's first choice spinner either, is he?
I think he is now. I think
he's playing
now
alongside John Holland.
Yeah, but towards the end of the season, he was bowling a lot more than Holland. I was going through his match by match numbers. He's bowling like 20 overs, going at 2s, taking 3 for 40 quite a lot in games where the other spinners aren't really doing that much. I've seen a few highlights of him. He gets a proper action on the ball in a way that actually quite few finger spinners do. But
they're not keen on playing 2 off spinners when Head also bowls off spin and is their backup spinner.
Yeah.
Or sorry, their sort of third choice spinner.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wonder if they'll be considering is just thinking like, well, we've got, 3 kind of all-time great quicks, one whose statistic, and then another whose statistics are absolutely incredible, and this guy is supposed to be faster than any of them. Do we just play to that strength I mean, I think it probably would be a mistake, but I think they will be thinking it, especially when you've got Green as well, just to have what you think, okay, the pitches might not suit them exactly, but Stark, Cummins and Hazelwood should be good enough to take wickets, especially against that sort of that batting lineup. I don't know.
Other news from Australia that came through this morning was that Cricket Australia have announced that they will not be fulfilling their upcoming series against Afghanistan. The CA statement said, following extensive consultation with relevant stakeholders, including the Australian government, Cricket Australia has decided that it is unable to proceed at this time with the upcoming ICC Super League three-match men's ODI series between Australia and Afghanistan scheduled in March. This decision follows the recent announcement by the Taliban of further restrictions on women's and girls' education and employment opportunities and their ability to access parks and gyms. CA is committed to supporting growing the game for women and men around the world, including in Afghanistan, and will continue to engage with the Afghanistan Cricket Board in anticipation of improved conditions for women and girls in the country. Joe, it's obviously very complicated, but what do you make of that decision?
Very complicated, difficult one, and I've gone backwards and forwards on this ever since the Taliban seized power, really, and what the future of Afghanistan cricket might look like. You know, you can look historically at the way international sport reacted to apartheid and exiled South Africa, and in part as a punishment for having an abhorrent regime, but also as a mechanism to actually force change. And South Africa's exile from sport was a contributing factor in the end of the apartheid regime. It's different with Afghanistan. You know, what's going on is appalling, and you know there's no defence for it clearly. But I'm not sure. Banning Afghanistan from playing cricket, which is what this decision could potentially lead on to, is not going to do any good. Is not going to cause the Taliban to change any policies. That they don't care. So I think it's a very tricky one. Whilst it's appalling and obviously needs to be condemned in the strongest possible terms, I'm not sure this is the way to go about it. We were debating this before the podcast, and Ben brought up a couple of points, which I think, further that really. In particular, Australia's match against them in the T20 World Cup.
Well, yeah. So obviously, when the Taliban took over, a couple of years ago, Afghanistan was scheduled to play a test in Australia, and then that was cancelled supposedly in protest of the Taliban regime. That was the statement at the time. Since then, Australia have chosen to play them in the T20 World Cup. They didn't pull out of that game, and now they have put out the ODI series. Okay, that decision to increase the restrictions on what women and girls in Afghanistan has come between those two things. But does this mean we're supposed to think that Cricket Australia thought the Taliban were basically fine when they played that T20 World Cup game? Or are we supposed to think that they didn't pull out of that because that would actually have some consequences and this is something that they actually don't hugely mind missing? I don't think
I have a poor record on playing the lesser nations, in inverted commas. I mean, England's record is not great, let's be honest, but Australia's is pretty appalling in recent history.
Yeah, I don't think either reading covers Cricket Australia in a huge amount of glory. The other thing is as Joe says, is like what decision is going to actually increase pressure on the government? And I guess neither to a huge extent. They don't seem to hugely want to be part of the global community in the way that South Africa did during the apartheid regime, I guess. But the one thing that this does do is it deprives Afghanistan's cricketers of a platform, and Afghanistan's cricketers could basically not be more opposed to the actions of their government. I mean, Rashid Khan is basically the cultural face of Afghanistan on the world stage, and he is very vocally against them. I mean, he's constantly tweeting, what's the hashtag? Hashtag let
Afghan girls learn.
Let Afghan girls learn. And he's also, you know, retweeting lots of other Afghanistan cricketers who are saying similar things. And this is going to, if there was a global exile, this would make those sorts of statements have less impact because, you know, he doesn't have the same platform to say it, which would be a shame, I think. And I think that it is tricky, but I mean, also the Taliban weren't, you know, voted into power. It's not a democratic thing. So you are punishing the people of a country, I think, for something that has been sort of foisted on them rather than something that is, you know, an active thing. In a way, I think it feels like it's punishing the people of a country and the sports team for actions of a government that they have no control over, and it won't hugely impact that government. And actually the thing that would hugely impact the government would be supporting the voice of these cricketers. And it also doesn't seem like there's been a dialogue between Cricket Australia and the Afghan players before the decision's been made. I mean, one of the players has come out and called for a boycott by Afghan cricketers of the BBL, and those Afghan cricketers have played a huge part in sort of popularising the BBL, and there's been some real good news stories. I mean, Rashid Khan is the face of the Adelaide Strikers, basically. And so it's kind of like, we're happy for these Afghan players to play in this competition when it kind of boosts, you know, the BBL's profile, but this other thing is not okay. It is a mess, basically, I think.
No, I'd agree with all that. And I think also the Afghanistan cricket team does not have to be a representation of its regime. And actually, Australia's decision is almost doing that more than if it would be if they played them. And also, just think back in the Football World Cup when you had, obviously it's not quite the same, but Iran continued to play and their players made a really powerful stance. They didn't agree with what was happening back at home, and this was an opportunity. And if they engage with the players, is like, what do you want to do? Is there a symbol or a gesture you want to make before the game? This is a good opportunity to do it. I think it's a missed opportunity, basically.
And there's also what's going to be talked about with when the ICC come to make a decision is that you officially you can't be a full member nation unless you have a women's team alongside your men's team. Ben, I mean, you pointed out that
so there's never been an organised women's game played in Afghanistan, I think.
So, you know, the ICC didn't have a problem with this until the Taliban took over. You know, that was obviously a significant change, but actually in terms of women's cricket happening in the country, it's not the seismic shift that maybe some people think it is, because it just wasn't there in the first place.
And this is maybe a separate point, but I think it would be nice to see full membership in the ICC separated from some of the things that it is tied to. So I think ideally Afghanistan would have been able to play test cricket while not being full members of the ICC, but that's not possible at the moment. And equally, I think Thailand have a pretty good case to be on an equal footing with Afghanistan in the world game because of the success of their women's team, but they don't really have a high quality men's team, which is what's precluding them from that.
On to the Pakistan-New Zealand tour. The test series ended 0-0. Sirfraz Ahmed scored 100 on the final day to keep Pakistan interested after a bold Tim Southee declaration. In the ODIs, it's 1-1 after two games. Naseem Shah took a fiver in the first game. I think no one has ever taken more ODI wickets from their first five games than Naseem Shah. Devon Conway scored 100 in the second game, which New Zealand won. New Zealand are the number one ranked side in the world at the moment, while that was Pakistan's first defeat in 10 games. India are going well against Sri Lanka in another ODI series. Kohli scored 100 in the first game. There's a man cad by Mohammad Shami when Dasun Shanaka was on 98 when the game was dead. That was retracted. Well, the appeal for that was retracted by Rohit Sharma. We're not getting into man cads again.
God. I thought we were going down that road.
The World Cup, though, is not that far away, and this has been a good week for assessing where teams are at and who is likely to play a part for various teams. Ben, I was wondering which of those four teams has impressed you the most.
They've all looked good, and actually it's only just increased the excitement for the World Cup. I guess Sri Lanka will be disappointed. I mean, it looks like they're not really competing in that second ODI, and they struggled in the first as well. They put a really good showing in the T20 series, but India look a cut above in that, when you might have said that Sri Lanka could well be, you know, real contenders with the Silverwood Revolution, etc. I mean, India, if Kohli is back to that, pre-2020 Kohli, at least in ODI cricket, then that is a significant advancement on where they were before, because, you know, and he's yet to have a properly statement ODI World Cup as well, where he's come in and dominated it and scored, you know, multiple hundreds. That's something that is still left for him to do. And at home, after the struggles of these few years, you wonder whether it's sort of scripted to be that way. India looks strong, but I think Pakistan also actually, I mean, that bowling attack when everyone is fit, and it's obviously a big if that will happen at the World Cup, but Naseem Shah looks exceptional. Obviously Harris Ralph, we know how good he is, and they've still got Shaheen to come back into it. And then also Shadab's not playing this series either. So they've got actually four brilliant frontline bowlers there. And Nawaz under Babar's captaincy is bowling really, really well as well.
Absolutely brilliant. I think four for 38 yesterday.
Yeah, and I think he's averaging less than 20 with the ball under Babar's captaincy. So he's really improved and is kind of bowling at his best right now. And then when you look at that batting lineup, I mean, Babar is ridiculously consistent. I think he might have passed 50 in 10 of his last 11 ODIs, which is obviously absurd. They've also got, I mean, Imam Al-Haq is only like a notch below Babar in the consistency. He's earlier in his career, but if he maintains that for the World Cup, and then Fakazaman is a very handy ODI batter. Rizwan, you'd expect, would come good at some point. So then you've got a top four, which you can rely on to make runs, and a bowling attack, which you can rely on to defend par totals. So they'll be a real threat as well. And then New Zealand are kind of showing why they are number one in the world a little bit. I mean, these are conditions that, you know, they've never played, or this, none of these players have played ODIs in Pakistan before. And yet they are competing well in this series. I mean, Conway just, well, he either gets a duck or 100 at the moment, which is not a bad place to be in. And yeah, I guess they also maybe might not even go into this as dark horses, possibly just as contenders, I guess. We'll see.
Ben, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week is from the Bangladesh Premier League, which is
obviously,
yeah, which has been, you know, a sort of fun tournament. There's been a few sort of weird things going on. Did we talk on last week's show about Shakib's?
No.
So those are both. It's a dull moment of the week. So obviously we know that Shakib and domestic umpires have a slightly strained relationship. There was from a couple of years ago, he was angry at an LBW decision being given not out. So proceeds to kick the stumps over and then rip them out of the ground and throw them to the ground. And then did a quite a funny apology where he said, hopefully this won't happen again in future. And I think he was right to hedge his bets, because it is happening again now. There was one where there was a wide that wasn't called. It was, to be fair, quite a distance over his head. And then he sort of marches up to the umpire and is sort of gesturing like, it's up here, what are you playing at, sort of thing. And then Mushfiqur Rahim has to sort of step in and put him away and get him back to his crease. And then recently he's actually, I think it's quite clever of him to be getting his tantrums at the umpires out early in a game rather than a sort of waiting for a key moment. So before the chase started in their most recent game, he was sort of standing on the boundary in his flip-flops, basically, just like not going into bat, but just shouting something at his batters, and then marched onto the field to have another quite animated discussion with the umpires, I think, about whether he could switch who would take strike to start with because of a spinner bowling and wanting the opposite hand to play. But yeah, it's I mean, I guess in general, maybe not a good example to see Shakib setting for player behaviour and that sort of thing.
He's not going to change now, though, is he?
No, that's the thing. Yeah,
I do find it interesting that he does this kind of thing in the BPL, but doesn't quite do it in international cricket. So there's obviously like an element of he feels like he can do what he wants.
Yeah, I think he would also, in his defence, sort of, he would say it's the standard of umpiring that gets him so angry, yeah, in Bangladesh. At least that's what he claims.
I think we might need a weekly Shakib in the BPL update from you, Ben. I don't know when that competition ends. Anyway, last week, Phil audaciously asked our listeners to get in touch to ban certain words and phrases for 2023. I said it was a dangerous thing to do at the time, and I think I've been proven right with Phil being in the firing line for most of the messages that have come in.
It's also, can I just say, it's unfair for you to do this at the end of the podcast when we've surely said loads of these as it's been going on.
We haven't had Phil on, though, have we?
We haven't had, exactly. So some of the phrases, I don't think we say that often. They're just phrases that people don't like being said in cricket. Johnny wanted to ban matchups, not just a word matchup, matchups in general. We'll put that to the Quick Viz guys when they're next on. Paul wanted to ban saying you can't write that. Again, I don't think we ever say that, but obviously people say that quite a lot in sport. Billy sent two different emails, so this is obviously on his mind quite a lot. Hi everyone, firstly I have to propose banning referring to Butch as anything other than former England Test captain Mark Butcher.
I like that one.
Which is good. I'd also like to ban the use of the phrase the rhythm or feel or flow of the game.
That's Phil.
And also hitting through the line of the ball, as to be honest, neither mean anything. We're just told that they do. Yeah, what does hitting through the line of the ball mean?
Well, I've always been confused as well, because you get playing with or against the turn as well, and that one is supposed to be good and the other's bad. But actually, playing against the turn, you'd think you'd be able to do that more with a straight bat in a way, like you're...
This is the Ben Jones book.
Yeah, is it? Okay. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's literally called the headline.
Hitting against the spin, yes. Yeah.
I've also never known what being a line bowler means. I kind of know what it means. So like someone like Scott Boland is a line bowler.
But more often than not, they're a line bowler, aren't they? Otherwise, yeah, they wouldn't be playing professional
exactly,
cricket.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've never thought that's a good description of what that type of bowling
I've got
is.
One that appears on Wisden's social media accounts quite a lot.
Yeah.
Take a bow. Just ban it.
Yeah,
that's fair.
Okay, that's fair.
One that I don't like is commentators referring to strokes as an amazing piece of improvisation when a batter plays a scoop shot or something. Like, there is no way that is improvised. If anything, those are the least improvised strokes in the game, because they are almost always premeditated and obviously take an absurd amount of practice to be able to do that. I mean, call them innovation, that's fine, but they are not improvised no, you know, by any definition of the word.
They know how to play them.
So Billy's second email was, actually, no, the worst one is any time an hour in a test match is described as so important. They are all important. Literally, they all matter. It's a nonsense phrase. You can listen to three consecutive tests and hear that every single hour is described as the most important. So it's very irritating, which that's very fair. Stephen says, my suggestion would be to ban matches being called a great or terrible advert for the game. I don't think this appears on the pod, but it definitely crops up a lot on BBC and Sky. I realise that the long-term future for Test cricket is bleak, and I would love for more people to fall in love with the best format of the game. But the idea that cricket is constantly being hawked around, always longing to appeal to some broader, unknown audience, can be quite irritating. Can't we just enjoy great matches on their own merit? I wouldn't expect a book review to conclude that a new novel was a great advert for literary fiction or whatever.
It's a great email. Point, and it really does speak to cricket's like inferiority complex.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. We're so insecure. Yeah. Or when anything good happens, we're like, oh, I hope someone watched. Yeah. I hope someone's watching.
And also, good things in sport are only good because there are also bad and boring things. Like, if every game was exciting, nothing would be, because it would take away the value of those. Like, you need, like, a, you know, the first Pakistan New Zealand test match was in a way a good advert for test cricket, because it made what England did so much more impressive. If everyone was able to do that, it wouldn't be that good, you know.
Stephen's email continues, in a similar vein, when something amazing happens in test cricket, you often see variations of, oh, who said test cricket was boring, eh? I don't know, some arsehole probably. Who cares what they think? We understand how the game works and why cricket at its best is unbeatable, but it's daft to pretend that it's always like the most exciting part. And one final phrase, one for Phil, what other ways exist of scoring 100 other than strumming it. We've actually privately tried to ban this ourselves and failed to do so.
It's very difficult though, because I mean, I've been subbing Phil's work for about 15 years now, and he's been subbing mine for the same length, so I can't even tell what were his. I end up putting them in my work, so they're just it's just an absolute mess, really. Stroke maker, greenhorn, southpaw,
yeah,
but I use them all now, so I can't complain either, really.
Stroke filled as well. You get to describe centuries, and like, what century has not been filled with strokes?
Yeah.
One thing actually related to the advert test cricket is when at the end of when a game has been quite boring and then gets exciting right at the end, someone will be having probably not watched much of the game, long live test cricket or something. And it's like, well,
probably not watch any of it if you think that. Yeah,
I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but I've never listened to another podcast which invites criticism so in such a kind of welcome way. We had the give a 5-star review but slag off Yaz for a while, which is enjoyable. Tell us how we're annoying. It's such a, you know, it's quite a brave thing to put out there.
Is this a great advert for cricket podcasts or not? I don't know.
And then finally, Joe said, long time listener, first time emailer, but couldn't resist this one. Phrases to be banned. Calling any major-ish test series marquee feels bad for this. When referring to averages, always saying a tick under or a tick over. Phil, again, bad for this. Just stop. Other than this, I love the podcast and look forward to following the 2023 year with you guys. Well, that's us told. I think that'll be the last time for quite a long time that we actively ask for criticism. But I guess this is a good opportunity to point out that if you do enjoy the show, and as I often say, if you've got 80 minutes in, I'm going to guess that you at least don't hate it. I do please ask you to leave a positive review either in the YouTube comments if you're watching us on YouTube, or giving us a nice 5-star review and even a comment review on the podcast app if that's where you listen to us. Anyway, that is the end of today's show. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. We will be back next week.
Podcast Network.